This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
Dewa Mavinga, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, says South Africa is putting politics ahead of justice.
South Africa's move sends the wrong message that really is about protecting al-Bashir, protecting the head of state from justice and accountability, and actually set a wrong precedent or have a domino effect to other African states following suit.
South Africa's Dewa Mavinga, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, saying South Africa is putting politics ahead of justice. Details next. Also, authorities have arrested at least 1,600 people in Ethiopia under a state of emergency declared October 8th. And a UN report says the number of migrant and unaccompanied children arriving in Europe is higher than ever. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, South Africa has announced it would withdraw from the International Criminal Court. Uganda says the African Union should consider the question at the January meeting. Analysts fear the South Africa decision, coming right after Burundi's decision to leave the court, could encourage other African nations to withdraw from the Hague-based tribunal, which prosecutes war crimes and crimes against humanity. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
South Africa's justice minister defended the decision to leave the ICC by citing his nation's interest in being a broker of peace in Africa. Justice and Correctional Services Minister Michael Masuta says South Africa can't provide a safe space for leaders to talk peace if they are compelled to comply with all the court's arrest warrants, like the one for Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir, wanted for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Bashir visited South Africa in mid-2015 for a summit of the African Union. South African officials declined to arrest him, saying he enjoyed diplomatic immunity. Masuta says the nation's cabinet decided this week that its only option was to leave the court, and has delivered a notification to the United Nations saying they would leave in 1 year. He said a bill to withdraw will now go to South Africa's parliament.
In exercising its international relations with foreign countries, particularly with countries in which serious conflicts occur or have occurred, South Africa is hindered by the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. This act and the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court compel South Africa to arrest persons who may enjoy diplomatic immunity under customary international law.
Earlier this week, Burundi also said it will leave the ICC, citing concerns that the court targets African leaders. The United Nations recently launched a probe into Burundi's political violence, triggered by President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term. Dewa Mavinga, a senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, says South Africa is putting politics ahead of justice.
South Africa's move sends the wrong message that really is about protecting al-Bashir, protecting the head of state from justice and accountability, and actually set a wrong precedent or have a domino effect of other African states following suit.
Anton Duplessis, managing director at the Pretoria-based Institute for Security Studies, said he is not concerned about a mass African exodus from the court. He believes many of the court's member states are not politically organized enough to agree on a withdrawal strategy. But he says he is worried about the reverberations in South Africa itself. The nation has been battered by political and legal controversies, some sparked by the leadership's refusal to arrest Bashir in 2015. And this, he says, doesn't help.
I think for South Africa, it's a particularly bad move because of what's going on domestically. The rule of law is under attack at a national level. South Africa's reputation is in tatters. Our ability to play the role that we used to play, the beacon of constitutional democracy, is being eroded every day.
As for the man who started all of this, President Bashir has not returned to South Africa since that controversial 2015 trip. When asked what his nation would do if the Sudanese president were to show up on South African soil, Masuta shrugged and declined to speculate. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Ethiopian authorities have arrested at least 1,600 people under a state of emergency declared October 8th. Human Rights Watch says the state of emergency may be formalizing a government practice that began when protests erupted a year ago. From Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more on the situation.
The Ethiopian government's response to protests that have spread over the past year was to implement a six-month state of emergency restricting expression, speech, and movement. Security forces are permitted to detain and search suspects in their homes without a court order. People are prohibited from accessing certain media like the Oromia Media Network and Ethiopian satellite television and radio. And authorities have the power to block any means of communication which could pose a threat for the peace and security of the country. Jawar Mohammed is executive director of the Oromia Media Network, which broadcasts into Ethiopia from the U.S. state of Minnesota.
Well, this is not the first time they attacked the Oromia Media Network. They have jammed us 15 times in the last 2.5 years. Right now, they are just legalizing what they have been doing. They have been arresting people who are seen watching the program. So what they did right now is not that much new. Overall, the state of emergency, particularly in Oromia, is nothing new.
Human Rights Watch Horn of Africa researcher Felix Horn also worries that officials are just formalizing the status quo.
I think that's one of the concerns we have about the state of emergency is it just codifies measures that have really, in practice, been in place since the protests began. But what we are hearing is there are far more military now in different areas of the country than there was before. And certainly the scale of the arrests seems to have picked up quite a bit.
The government says 1,645 people have been arrested in different parts of the country since the state of emergency was declared. Even when people are not arrested, security forces can be brutal, according to this resident of the Oromia region. He says after the state of emergency was announced, armed forces, those who round up people, have taken control of these villages. They beat people at night after 6 p.m., going from one house to another. They are asking people not to watch or use their satellite dishes, and don't watch ESAT and OMN. If people's homes are found with these satellite dishes, they beat them brutally, even when they are bleeding. The United States has voiced concern about the restrictions and the authorization of detentions without warrants, saying the tactics would further enshrine the type of response that has failed to ameliorate the recent political crisis. Several requests for response from Ethiopia's communication minister went unanswered. The crackdown was announced after recent violence against mostly foreign-owned businesses, as well as protests over land issues and human and political rights that started in November 2015 across the Oromia and Amhara regions. Human Rights Watch says at least 500 people have been killed in anti-government protests over the past year. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
A new report by the United Nations International Children's Fund, UNICEF, says the number of migrant and unaccompanied children arriving in Europe is higher than ever. This year's numbers show that 90% of migrant children are unaccompanied, compared to last year's figure at 75%. In a related issue, European Union ministers agreed this morning to a new repatriation process for the huge influx of migrants to return home. For details on the latest migrant developments, Kim Lewis spoke with reporter Josephine McKenna in Rome.
Well, UNICEF says there is a higher number than ever of unaccompanied young migrants, children who are coming to Europe across the Mediterranean without their parents, and that's quite significant, stressing that the European Council of the European Union should be putting in place more measures to address the needs of these vulnerable migrants. UNICEF says this year the arrivals in Italy are without precedent, and around 20,000 unaccompanied children arrived in Italy by sea between January and October. UNICEF also says 90% of the children are unaccompanied compared to 75% last year.
Have they said how they're going to try to reunite them with their families, or what is the next step to try to address this issue?
Well, many of these children have suffered trauma. They've seen people drown, sometimes their family members who have perished on the journey. Many of the children have suffered injuries from oil on the dinghies as they make the crossing. They need more protection, according to UNICEF. Basically, UNICEF is calling on Europe and the rest of the international community to protect child refugees and migrants, especially unaccompanied children, from exploitation and violence, and end the detention of children who are seeking refugee status or migrating from one country to another to escape poverty or war or other difficult situations.
I understand you have a new development to tell us about with ministers agreeing to repatriation.
Yes, the interior ministers of Italy, Germany and France on Friday have agreed to increase the number of repatriations of what they consider to be illegal economic migrants, sending them back to African countries. Now, the three ministers are planning to coordinate these repatriation measures, and they have agreed to ask the European Union for what they call a serious and massive engagement to try and manage the numbers and ensure that people do not deserve political asylum to be repatriated to their own countries. The EU Immigration Commissioner, Dimitris Avramopoulos, said this was very important and Italy was on the front line of security and immigration and this had to be taken very seriously.
And I understand there's a new Italian survey out that's saying more controls are wanted to resolve this migrant crisis.
A new Italian survey shows that 57% of those surveyed want more controls in the countries of origin to resolve what they consider to be an escalating migrant crisis. There's also signs that people who run hotels in Italy don't want to host migrants. That was also shown in the survey. An interesting sort of trend here where on the one hand we're seeing many communities welcome migrants and try and accommodate them, but others growing tired of what they consider to be the burden of accepting a growing number of migrants who arrive across the Mediterranean. And we've seen that just even in the last few days. Yesterday, 1,400 migrants were rescued off the coast of Italy, between Italy and Libya.
So these people that were surveyed are people living in Italy?
Correct. And it seemed to indicate that there is a trend of people becoming a little bit impatient with having to shoulder the burden, not seeing enough support coming from the rest of Europe and wanting to see more action from the Italian government and other governments to try and control this tidal wave of migrants that we've seen in particular this year.
Has the EU released more funds to help support the migrants?
There has been the release of more funds, and in particular in Italy, to create 3,000 new positions to assist in the integration of certain people who have arrived from Morocco, Nigeria, Senegal, and other countries. So that is a positive move, but perhaps not quite enough to deal with the funding that's needed to run the many migrant centres here in Italy that are dealing with this wave of migrants that have landed, particularly in the last few months.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Rome. 18 past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Drought and a shortage of currency has plagued the world's premium leaf tobacco this year. Despite those troubles, tobacco farmers had a good season. They continue to flourish and maintain their reputation for high-quality tobacco despite lots of challenges. Kudze Zivanvashi has the story from Harare.
Zimbabwean tobacco farmers were victims of the country's biting economy and a major drought, but when it came to selling their tobacco at the auction floors as a result, it affected their productivity. But tobacco industry and marketing board spokesperson Ishone Sumoyo says they prevailed.
The current economic situation was a challenge in that farmers could not access money from the banks, because this season, unlike the previous season, we wanted farmers to be bankable, so we had everyone getting their money through the banking system. But then there was a cash challenge from the banks. For instance, at some point they were said farmers were supposed to be treated as corporates and they were supposed to be able to withdraw 10,000, but then that wasn't possible. Now the challenge is for farmers, they have got laborers who probably don't have bank accounts and they needed to pay them, and that created problems as they were trying to prepare for the next season, as their workers will not then be able to get cash because at some point they were getting as little as $1,000.
The economy is not the only challenge farmers have faced as they had to deal with the changing climate following the El Nino climate. That was the main cause for drought in the country, which left millions insecure. Moyo says the tobacco farmers have emerged victorious.
For instance, we encountered the El Nino weather phenomenon, but even despite of that, the yield was very good because we had about 202.2 million kgs compared to 198.9 million kgs last season. So the success is that farmers were able to implement good agronomic practices whereby, you know, even though things were difficult, they managed to produce a good yield.
Unlike the cotton prices that have been dropping, Moyo says tobacco prices have been resilient to the country's declining economy.
If you look at the average price this season, the average price was at $2.94 per kg. Last season it was slightly higher, it was at $2.95 per kg. But then you realize that the challenge was mainly with the lower reapings. That's where, you know, the prices were poor. But then as you moved up to the upper reapings, the leaves and the tips, the prices improved. So, but then the average price was slightly lower by a cent compared to last season.
Zimbabwean tobacco is sold at auction floors in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, and later exported to various markets.
The major country where tobacco in Zimbabwe and generally in the world goes to is China. But for Zimbabwe, we also have quite a significant proportion going to South Africa. So those are the major export destinations for tobacco.
Moyo says preparations for the forthcoming season are underway and the groundwork promises an equally good yield.
The preparations for the next season are quite good because, for instance, if you look at the number of registered farmers, so far we've registered over 60,000. When the total that we had last season was 81,000, meaning we have got over 60% that have already registered. This is up from what we had last season, because last season by the same time we had about 57,000 that had registered. So it means farmers are preparing for this coming season, and we're also taking them through agronomic lessons, because probably this season we will probably, according to the weather reports, we may experience a La Nina, which is the opposite of El Nino, which we experienced last season. So we are preparing them if we encounter heavy rain so that we can be able to produce a good yield again.
Moyo says the bulk of the tobacco grown in Zimbabwe is through contract farming, which helps farmers access inputs and bankrolls the farming till the harvesting period.
Farmers that were contracted last season, the same companies that we're contracting are going on with, you know, contracting farmers, and I mean more. Apparently I don't have statistics as to how many have been contracted, but what I can say is 80% of our tobacco is coming from contract, whereas 20% is coming from the auction system. So yeah, generally contract is what's driving the, you know, the tobacco farming in Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe still produces high-quality tobacco against all the economic and climate odds. Only time can hold on to the status quo in the following season, considering Zimbabwe's mounting problems. This is Kudzai Nawashe, reporting for Voice of America from Harare.
Last month, the international NGO Bloomberg Philanthropies and the U.S. Department of Commerce co-sponsored the U.S.-Africa Business Forum. The New York event brought together business leaders, African policymakers, development experts, and entrepreneurs to promote trade and business partnerships between the United States and Africa. Organizers say that increased economic cooperation across sectors will benefit and enrich everyday Africans while also being profitable for companies both within Africa and the U.S. VOA's Adam Phillips was there.
In Manhattan's posh Plaza Hotel, delegations from 44 African countries, including 29 African heads of state, attended the two-day 2016 U.S.-Africa Business Forum. In a lengthy speech, U.S. President Barack Obama said he was mindful of Africa's many daunting challenges, yet he also noted that business partnerships between the U.S. and Africa had vastly increased in recent years. He said expanded business and trade between them will mean future prosperity for the peoples of both places.
And wherever I've gone, from Senegal to South Africa, Africans insist they do not just want aid, they want trade. They want partners, not patrons. They want to do business and grow businesses and create value and companies that will last. And the United States is determined to be that partner for the long term.
Outside the gilded grand ballroom where Mr. Obama spoke, the air crackled with informal networking and strategy discussions. Several times a day, business and trade deals were trumpeted to the press. For example, MasterCard and the Commercial Bank of Ethiopia announced a partnership that will make it easier for Ethiopians in the U.S. to send home remittances. General Electric and the U.S. African Development Foundation touted a program that will target off-the-grid energy companies that are owned and managed by women. And the Kenyan startup Moinga Networks Limited will partner with Microsoft Corporation to offer broadband internet access to rural folk for as little as $3 a month.
We're trying to get people who are not connected to be connected to the digital economy and digital world.
That's Tim Hobbs, Moinga's director. He said that the $3 million in financing his company will receive from Microsoft and other investors will help his company create hotspots that enable everyday people to access the internet on their smartphones.
We're looking for sustainable social impact businesses is what drives us. It's got to be sustainable. It's got to be able to support itself. And if we can actually do some good with that, then so much the better. And we do have a myriad of individual stories of people finding opportunities to earn money on the internet. We have people who now provide homework services. They get paid through PayPal to do assisting with homework assignments. And on people looking for a job, people also save themselves huge amounts of money by getting on the internet. So rather than having to go to places, they can start using information rather than petrol to get there.
Frank McCosker is general manager of affordable access and smart financing for Microsoft's For Africa initiatives. He says this project is a new approach to investing for his company.
We're looking at innovation, access, and skills. And this is purely business. We distribute through local partners. For every dollar that Microsoft makes, our local partners in Africa are making between $7 and $10. So when we're successful, our partners are successful.
To do that, Microsoft needs skilled partners in several areas, including information technology, computer engineering, and software development. So Microsoft is committed to training 200,000 Africans. Half will be government workers, half will be youth.
That's where we're targeting. The government's our biggest clients. Youth is the future.
The next step, says McCosker, is to get the innovations and prototypes those trainees develop to market.
So that they can make money and do good business and become successful. So we build them on our skills, and then they build their business on our platform.
According to its website, the U.S.-Africa Business Forum mobilized $9.2 billion in trade and investment for African business sectors. But it's not just about the money. As one U.S. official told VOA, enhanced trade also helps create the conditions for personal freedom and the pursuit of happiness. That, in turn, fosters stability, she said, which is clearly in everyone's interest. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyi Suwuhibi in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Kurt Bynum, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.